It has been nearly 2 months since the lectionary started us on a journey through 1 and 2 Samuel, two books that I want again to point out should not be understood as two books in a series, but two volumes of a single text, divided because it is too long to fit on a single scroll. I am leaving for 2 weeks, during which time you will finish the lectionary choices from Samuel and the story of David. But do not worry, I will be back and we will pick up in 1 Kings, which continues the story of the early monarchy with David's son and successor, Solomon. We began this not quite series on June 6th, when we read that the people were demanding a king to rule over them so that they would be like other nations. God, through Samuel, warned the people what that would mean. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take 1/10 of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take 1/10 of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. It is worth noting that neither Samuel nor God say that they are talking about a bad king. The people, though, they do not listen or they do not care. They continue to demand a king, and so God chooses and Samuel anoints Saul to be king. Saul does not work out, and so God chooses and Samuel anoints David to be king. In a story that may well have served as a model for Cinderella, even as Samuel, much like the prince, has to call for the youngest sibling to be fetched from chores. David then comes to serve in Saul's court, first as a musician and then following David's defeat of Goliath as a soldier and officer. Saul grows jealous of David, realizing that God's favor has shifted, and so Saul tries to have David killed. First, by sending David into unwinnable battles, a tactic we will see again. But David survives and wins those battles. Saul then sends men to kill David in bed, but David escapes with the help of Saul's daughter and David's first wife, Michal. Eventually, David becomes king. And he sets out to unify the political and religious centers of Israel in his newly conquered capital, Jerusalem. David is now starting to feel his power, starting to feel like a king. And now it is worth reminding you again that Saul's and Samuel's warning was not about bad kings. It was not a value judgment by which to judge good and bad kings. It was a warning about the behavior of all kings. Over the last 2 weeks, we talked about David bringing the ark to Jerusalem, how he had to stop for 3 months after a man touched the ark and died in that journey. In moving the ark, David is beginning to try to control God, a pattern that continued in last week's text when David decided that God needed a house like David's. Today's lectionary begins with another warning about how power is affecting David. It tells us that it was the time when kings go out to battle. David sent Joab with his officers and all of Israel with them. The first part of that sentence sets the expectation. Kings go to battle. The second tells us what David did. He sent others. The next sentence pushes this point more clearly, but David remained at Jerusalem. David's rise to power came at the head of his army. His first military accomplishment was the victory in single combat against Goliath when he was still young. under Saul, David led troops, and this is why he was able to unify Israel, because he was personally in command. But now that David is king, he no longer leads directly. He sends his general Joab and his officers to army and army to battle, while David remains behind in safety and comfort. But David does not stay out of trouble. No, David goes to the roof and he sees a woman bathing. And once again, David sends someone to find out who she is. And he learns that she is the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Uriah is later listed as a member of the 30, likely members of David's personal guard and senior military advisors. And David sends someone to bring Bathsheba to him. David is directing the events in this story, but David has become passive, sending others to do the work for him. David, since the incident of moving the ark, has started to become reactive. And David's relationship with God and the people change as David increasingly tries to serve himself first. Completely given over to this self-service, David does not care that Bathsheba is married, does not care that her husband is one of David's strongest and most trusted warriors, does not care that Bathsheba may not want or choose this, does not care what consequences he might create for her. And so he summons Bathsheba and, as the text tells us, he lay with her. And in case you missed that euphemism, the text makes it clear Bathsheba becomes pregnant. Bathsheba, who was not in a position to refuse David, who had no control, no ability to withhold consent. But now the story starts to change. When David summoned Bathsheba, we see that David has lost control now, even of himself. And so we see, as the story moves on, God begins to take control from David. First, in the way that David learns of the pregnancy, Bathsheba mirrors David. David sent people to fetch her. Bathsheba sends a messenger to tell David that she has become pregnant. From this point forward in David's story, he is reacting to events set in motion by others. So David sends for Uriah and spends several days trying to get Uriah to go home, to wash his feet, to engage in other euphemisms, all of which point to the fact that David's plan is to convince Uriah and then everyone else that the father of David and Bathsheba's child is Uriah. Uriah, however, is not having it. He remains a loyal and faithful soldier, even in the face of David's betrayal of the wider kingdom by David refusing to lead the army himself, and in the face of David's specific betrayal of Uriah. Now, we do not know if Uriah was suspicious or if he was just a faithful soldier, but the text does have Uriah making some subtle jabs at David that emphasize how David is no longer serving God or the kingdom, but serving himself. David did not accompany his armies, but remained behind in comfort. Uriah, though, even when summoned back, does not return to the comfort of his home, but he camps with the palace guard. Uriah remains on duty. David asks Uriah why he does not go home, and Uriah's answer is significant. Uriah says, "The ark and Israel and Judah remain in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink, to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." This is an almost exact inversion of our story from David last week, when David says, "See, now I am living in a house of cedar, but the ark of God stays in a tent." Last week, we talked about trying to make God in our image, about trying to control God, about how David decided to impose his wants and desires on God, to model God on himself. But Uriah follows the example set by God. I want to make this explicit because I think it's possible that we can, reading now, miss the rebuke of David in Uriah's words, but I do not think David would have missed them. Uriah is telling David that they should both be in the field with the army instead of in comfort in the capital. Uriah is telling David that David should have seen to the care of the people before David built a palace. Uriah is warning David that David has moved away from serving God and the people is instead serving himself. But David, instead of listening to the criticism, borrows a tactic from Saul. Saul tried to arrange for David to be killed in battle. David succeeds in arranging for Uriah's death in battle. And not only Uriah's, but also the deaths of those soldiers under Uriah's command, all in David's effort to cover his own sin and to claim Bathsheba for himself. Next week, the lectionary will tell you what the prophet Nathan thinks of all of this. And I'm sorry if I'm stepping on you, John Dan, but I don't think it will be a surprise to anyone to learn that Nathan and God are not pleased. They are not pleased with David's actions in this story. And while God does keep the promise to keep David's line on the throne, the rest of David's story will be filled with a number of conflicts as David's children try to work out the succession and rule around him. You will hear one episode in that story on August 8th from Reverend Roy Knight. And on August 15th, I will be back. And we will talk more about Bathsheba, because while our text today leaves her mostly silent, speaking only once through a messenger, we will hear more from her. David rose to the kingship by serving God and the people, but having attained it, having become a king, David becomes like the kings described by Samuel. He begins to serve himself, begins to force the people to serve him. And David tries to tame and to control God, but God will not be controlled. And for that, friends, thanks be to God. And I am sorry to leave you on a to be continued.